is a Bible study session, I have to say, for this microphone here, led by Elmer Witt, entitled Good Mathematics, Lousy Theology. We did this in a shorter version about an hour ago, and at the end of it, I asked Jerry Evenrub, was there any music, hymns and stuff that were set to the things that we were talking about, which is about parables and sharing. And he said there's some good stuff, and he got one out. He suggesting we would sing it to begin with.
It's sort of on the blackboard, but you can't probably read it from where you're sitting. But I'd like to play it through once for you. It was written last year, 1987. The text is by Brian Wren, who is from Oxford, England. And I was with Brian last year, and he shared this with me.
Around. That's great. Thanks, Jerry, very much. I'm not Vern Firetop. That's pretty clear. I was going to call this session not Vern Firetop, but I thought that was a little negative. So it's going to be about, as I said, bad mathematics. Good mathematics and lousy theology. Before we get there, I'd like you to help me a bit. Tell me things about God. What do you know about God? Words, phrases.
Loving.
Anybody? Pardon?
Loving.
Omniscient.
Omniscient.
Eternal.
Everywhere.
Forgiving.
Yahweh. Trinity.
Trinity, you said. Excuse me.
All powerful.
Mysterious.
Suffering. Universal.
Creator.
Father.
Savior. Now, would anybody be willing to repeat those for me? How come? Let me tell you a story. My mentor in music, for whom I'm so, so grateful, was a fellow named Gerhard Schroth. Richard, I think, knows him too. Jerry died some years ago. Didn't take care of himself very well. Died, I think, with his third stroke while directing choir at a Christmas Eve service in Racine, Wisconsin. I miss Jerry very, very much. I see his wife and hear from her every once in a while, his wife, but I haven't written to her about that death because I haven't even really dealt with that death well yet. his daughter Susan and her husband were visiting my wife and me in suburban Chicago on a Saturday for lunch. And we got talking about Jerry, and a terrible surprise to me, Susan pounded the table and said, "Damn it, Jerry, I've got unfinished business with you. You didn't have any right to leave." That stuck with me very, very seriously, and of course led me to think, which of my children has unfinished business with me? So I set out. It took about a year to be alone with each of my kids, different parts of the country, and ask them if they had unfinished business with me. I was here at Holden with my daughter Barbara, who now lives in Seattle, and it took about a day and a half for Barbara to answer me. We walked out towards Heart Lake, and finally she was able to tell me. She said, "Dad, you abandoned me." I didn't know it, but she was right. We had lived in California. She was 2 years old when we moved from California. I'd been in a parish and been home every night, been with her all the time. We moved to Chicago and I became director of youth ministry for the Missouri Synod and traveled 70,000 miles a year, obviously because this was very important to do. I learned later, of course, how dumb it was. But I left her alone and I abandoned. So we spent most of the time in the day, daytime, afternoons, the rest of that time that Barbara was here with us, up in the second story of Chalet 8, because Barbara wanted to be held. She was in her early 20s. She would sit on my lap, and we would snuggle, and I would hold her. And I still, now, each time I go to Seattle, work at finding time alone with Barbara. Time with no one else there, where, like her mother and her father, she talks on and on, and I listen. Could you tell me that story back? What's the difference between the list you gave me and the story I told?
It's more within the realm of our experience.
Okay. The list is abstract, whereas the story is personal.
I think a narrative is always easier to remember than lists anyway, no matter what the content is.
Okay. Someone else?
Relate to the emotional power.
Mm-hmm. The story conveys its meaning, whereas the name only refers to something.
Mm-hmm. I suppose we can relate back to our own lives. Mm. My life is scooping, just trying to make a buck. Trying to bring home some bacon, not being at home.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. Very true.
Someone else?
It's the same thing. It's application of what we talk about. The characteristics of God being, it's just application.
Mm-hmm.
Our experience.
It does identify with our humanity. You may not have abandoned your daughter or your child, but I think each of us knows what abandonment means. And it takes those words that we said before, it seems to me, it's an effort to take some of those words and tie it to the understanding of what we mean, what we understand to mean to be human. And it catches us up And that's clearly why, it seems to me at least, that Jesus told stories. They were not innocent stories. They were almost all hard stories. In fact, Jesus, I think, told his most difficult things, his most radical things, his most upsetting, if you will, things, in stories. They sounded easy. They recognize what's going on. And yet, if you heard well, if you had ears to hear, you heard well, you'd have to be somehow disturbed, somehow changed. We believe, I believe, Jesus never told innocent stories. They always had a catch to them. And it was part of God trying to catch us. What Vern is going to be doing this week is talking about stories that Jesus told from St. Luke. He's going to spend some time, much more than we're doing right now, about why those stories were never innocent. And we surely let him do that and look forward to his doing that. But I wanted you to have a feeling for that when we look at the story that deals with good mathematics and lousy theology. I wonder if you'd be willing to, I don't know if you have a copy, but if you do have a copy of the scriptures, if you would turn to Matthew chapter 18, 21 to 35. Don't read it. Just keep your finger in that spot, will you? And let me read it from a different perspective. This is a book, The Cotton Patch Parables of Liberation, by Clarence Jordan. Some of you may know Clarence and his works, and now dead, and I regret his departure. He had a master's in theology and a doctorate from a theological seminary in, I think, in Nashville, and in New Testament Greek. But he is best known for using that in behalf of the poor. He started Koinonia Farms down in Georgia and brought together black and white people long ago, at a time when this was just not accepted at all, and was known for the way he retold the stories in order for them to be heard more pointedly by the people who were around. And I'd like to read that to this the story that you have your finger at there, from his understanding of it and his translation of it. Then Rock sidled up. That's Peter, of course. Rock sidled up and said, and asked, "Sir, how often should I forgive my brother when he keeps doing me wrong? Seven times?" That's good mathematics. It's lots more than most people, right? "I wouldn't say seven times," Jesus replied. 70 times seven. That's why the God movement, he calls the kingdom of God the God movement. I sort of like that. The God movement is like a big businessman who wanted to settle the accounts with his customers. And as he started to do so, one customer came in who owed him a bill of more than $10,000. He had nothing to pay on the account, so the businessman told the sheriff to put up for sale everything the guy had and apply it to the debt. But the fellow did a song and dance. "Please give me more time and I'll pay every cent," he begged. The businessman was touched by the guy's pitiful pleas, so he let him go and marked off the debt. Then that same guy went out and found a man who owed him $100. Grabbing him around the neck, he choked him and said, "Pay me the money you owe." "Please give me a little more time," the man begged, "and I'll pay every cent." But he refused, and instead, he swore out a warrant for him. When the little man's friends found out about it, they were really upset. So they went and told the big businessman all that happened. And then the big businessman sent for the guy who owed him the huge debt and said to them, "You low-down bum, I marked off all that debt for you because you begged me to. Shouldn't you then have been kind to the little man just as I was kind to you?" And still hot under the collar, he turned the fellow over to the law to be thrown into the clink until every last dime of the debt had been paid. and my spiritual father will treat you along the same line. Unless every single one of you forgives your sister and brother from the heart. Yes?
It's my understanding that in Scripture, in this, in our version, it's 10,000 talents, not $10,000. Mm-hmm. And a talent in the days of old was many more than dollars. It amounted to like $10 million, no. $1 million. So that puts a whole, in our society with $10,000, we all can conceive of making that in a year. Mm-hmm. But in those, if you turn it to $1 million or $10 million, there is no way that I can even conceive of paying that debt back. And that puts an entirely different relationship on the man who forgave the debt and the man who asked it, oh, I'll pay it back. You know, sometimes we think, oh, I'll make that right. Well, in God's eyes, there is no way we can pay him back for the debt that we owe him. And that just released me so greatly when I learned that, that it was like, there is no way I can even attempt. It took me way out of the works area and just let me revel in the fact that it was pure grace alone. And that therefore, that forgiveness that I extend to my brother for his debt, I mean, it doesn't come from anything I'm doing with my God, except receiving that forgiveness.
Of course, you would, I'm sure, readily admit $10,000 for most of the people in the world is impossible. For middle-class white Americans.
But Scripture is always relevant to the people reading it, and we need to keep that in mind.
Yeah. I always like to point out how middle-class we are in our understanding. That's very important for us to do, because we have to allow for other understanding. And I have another one after a while.
Okay.
That this has nothing to do with money at all. It has nothing to do with any of that, but it has to do with systems. Yep. We'll come back to that after a bit. Just a second with that.
Okay.
Thank you. Good sharing. Thanks. Somebody else?
Doesn't it somewhat relate to also, I feel like in the middle, you know, we like to have forgiveness from someone for a gear or what is a debt or somewhere we goofed up. But why is it so hard for us to say, I'm sorry when we have offended someone else? And it's in within the same context.
Sure.
That's probably the hardest thing for me, and I think for many, to say is I'm sorry. Yet we want the response from the other side.
Can you think of a time when you ask someone else for forgiveness? Anybody willing to share?
I sometimes ask my children for forgiveness because there are times that I will overreact and realize afterwards that it wasn't what they were doing that really was the basis of the degree of my reaction. Usually there's some reason that it's that I got mad, but then sometimes I think we put other things into it. And that's a little tricky because on one hand you don't want your authority to be all gone, but I think sometimes your authority is greater if they understand that they aren't to blame for the full weight of it.
Okay. Yes.
I come from a very, very kind, nice family, and I've always experienced forgiveness. I never had any difficulty with that, and about 5 years ago, I experienced unforgiveness from another member of the family, and it's very harsh, and it's ongoing, but in a way, it's been kind of a blessing, because it sure opened my eyes to a lot in the world that I hadn't seen before, and I think it helped make me more forgiving of others. It helped, it taught to me the meaning of true forgiveness, or easy forgiveness, I suppose.
Okay, thank you. Someone else?
I think it's real hard for us to do, because if we do it, we feel like we've lost. I think we're brought up to think that if we ask someone to forgive us, then we've lost the fight. You know, in my family, it was sort of the message. We gave in.
Yeah.
it's easier for me to ask for forgiveness of someone I already know and trust and love. And if the thing is small. But if the thing is bigger, or if it's someone who's just an acquaintance, not a true friend, then I always fall into self-justification along with my apology. It's not, you know, I'm not really asking for forgiveness. I'm saying I'm sorry, but then I'm explaining why.
Someone else.
I think it's very easy to say, forgive me, or I'm sorry, but it's harder to say, I wronged you.
Do you have any feelings about why? There's some were said already, but...
Well, I think it's just a matter of depth. For me, it's saying I'm sorry is very shallow. It kind of puts the pressure on the other person, too. To forgive you when you say I'm sorry, then you expect them to say, well, that's all right.
This room reminds me of what you're talking about. You can tell how much it's indelible. I was sitting, I think, about there, leading session. This is, I don't know, 15 years ago or 20, I don't know. And right up there, were sitting some people who were clearly, quote, fundamentalists. Now, I've already taken care of them, right, by the word I used to describe them. I really didn't like what they were saying. And so, as I'm able to do, unfortunately, I cut them to shreds. I just cut them to shreds. Terrible, terrible. The worst thing about it, I didn't know it. Wasn't aware of it. They left the village, and a woman, pastor's wife, who was sitting over here, came and talked to me about it and asked me if I knew what I'd done. I think I learned a bit of a lesson that time, and you can tell that I still regret that I didn't have a chance to get to them somehow. Later on, it's only been a couple years ago, I was sitting here and didn't cut somebody apart, but really put somebody down. She was sitting right over there. But boy, I didn't let her get out of the room. I said to her, I don't know if you are able or ready forgive me, but I'm asking, because what I did was really a shame, an insult, and really something, in my mind, very bad. So that process, you know, is a growing one for me. I don't promise that I could do, I don't know which of those I do each time, but this room reminds me of a couple of times when I really needed to do something, and once I got to it, the other one I didn't even have the chance. It's tough. Tough for me. I think I'm more willing to work at it now than I was years ago, and I say that only to give credit to the grace of God, and not at all that it works well, or that my motivations are clear. You know, I maybe even wanted other people to know I could do that or something, I don't know what all the motivations would be, but at least I think I was pushing in a better direction than earlier anyway. But it's tough.
Yeah. I'm continually surprised how just a person who you know that you have hurt and are defending inside yourself everything that you did touches with a physical touch, and all of a sudden all the defenses are gone.
And you're ready to say, sorry. How powerful a physical touch is from
a person who's
that
you've
hurt.
Yeah. Thank you. Somebody else.
Yeah. I have a hard time asking people for forgiveness. I think I can't do that with my children. And that's, somehow I've been able to do a number of things with my children. I've learned to do some things that I couldn't do before anywhere, but I haven't been able to translate that yet. But maybe one of the hardest parts, maybe it's is forgiving myself when I've done something, when I realize I've hurt somebody or created a bad situation or did something that main part of it comes from not being able to forgive myself, that I could, even if I say I'm sorry, somehow I still did it, and I, you know, I'm bad me or whatever. I mean, and that's a how, you know, to bridge that one.
You brought up about children, and you did too. It's such a critical area, because I work in mostly in the animal field, and the impact one has on an animal early in life has almost eternal consequences, as you, and we see it in children. And I'm reminded of one of Ken Erickson's stories out of Power of Praise. The incident was really repeated in two locations, one of them a foreign parish, Catholic parish, and the altar boy was helping the priest, and the boy dropped the cruet of wine, and the priest banged him one and said, leave and never come back, and he didn't. It was Marshal Tito. And another occasion, similar situation, the altar boy was helping, and he dropped the cruet of wine, and the priest, with a twinkle in his eye, said, you probably grew up to be a good priest. And it was Fulton J. Sheehan. He was a remarkable spokesman. But I'm also reminded of another one, Gospel According to Andy Capp. When Flo said to Andy one day, this is ridiculous, 3 days without speaking, forgive me, you know. Mm-hmm. I was in the wrong. And then, as he walks out, probably on his way to join a friend to the pub, she gives him a big juicy smackaroo, which he then left and joined his friend. And his friend says, I heard that. He says, it takes a remarkable person to forgive when they're wrong. And Andy says, yeah, him takes a better person to forgive when they're not in the wrong.
Yes. Oh, I thought you had it. Somebody else. Yes, please.
Mr. President, with that part of the parable, which the big businessman doesn't forgive, really. He mm-hmm. says he forgives, but then reneges and throws the guy in the clink until he pays the debt in full.
Mm-hmm.
One wonders if a parable is to be a pattern of how God operates, if he truly then forgives our sins completely. Mm-hmm. Or do we have to continue with an ongoing relationship with God in order to maintain that complete forgiveness of sins?
That's the thing I want to come back to from the comment of the lady in the corner. In this story that Jesus told, the guy that didn't forgive doesn't get off the hook. He's thrown the clink. So there seems to be some part of the story that says there's accountability along with forgiveness. Now, when we get that in the way of this thing she was saying, in the way of the cause, that our accountability causes the forgiveness. If we're accountable, then we'll be forgiven. But to just have grace, that's why I'm wearing this t-shirt today. It is grace of God, but to have what some people call cheap grace, so that, you know, Christians forgive, and so everybody's okay, and it's all taken care of, and nothing happens because of it, then that seems to me the story isn't being followed. We bring lots of things to Jesus' story, and they're probably only real when they bug us. If they don't bug us, maybe not dealing with this. John Schramm has a lovely tape here in our tape library that says, let's do away with Bible classes, Bible study. And his point is, unless something happens that erupts during that time, it's probably wasted effort. And so he wasn't so sure we should be bothering about it. You can listen to his story, listen to his tape and argue with him if you're lying. And the point simply is, the dealing with the Word of God is to be confronted by God and in God. And that doesn't mean how bad we are only, but how much we miss the possibilities, or how much we deceive ourselves. I think the best definition for sin is self-deception. And the people that are best at self-deception, it seems to me we were saying before, are Christians. That we deceive ourselves, that it's all been taken care of. So that's a tough problem. I'd like to start a movement, but I've been saying this for so long, it's apparent to me that I don't really want to start a movement. But I suppose it's a nice way to talk about it. So if you'll take that as a part of speech or something like that. And that is, I'd like to try to correct Martin Luther, because that they tell me from some of his writings, and I think even Jerry Pelican substantiates this. It was probably in some of the stuff that was written down in his table talk. And I think it's Marty says he's the only divine whose after-dinner drinks comments during after-dinner drinks were written down as devotions. So between there, he was at his best or at his worst, I don't know. But he almost made what he called the consolation of the brethren, what I would call the consolation of sisters and brothers. He almost made it a sacrament. I wish he had. I really wish he had. I think he meant by that, there isn't a lot written about it that I know of, is that people ought to sit down and talk with one another about things that are really serious in their life on a regular basis, on some I don't mean formula, but in some way that is the expectation. Now, we mess up baptism, and we mess up the Eucharist, too, and we probably mess up the mutual consolation of sisters and brothers. I don't mean to say to have another sacrament would do something, but Martin made up his own definition for a sacrament, and he could have made up a different one, I think, and included this one. I'd really like it if we were in an expectation to talk with one another more seriously, as we've been doing a little bit here, and sharing the places that we're coming from, the places that we're going to. How many conversations within the church and wherever else it may be are still about the twins or whatever else it may be, and bless the twins and bless all the conversations we have. But I think often the meat of the stuff that counts in our lives, doesn't get said. And there ought to be a way of calling ourselves back. Maybe if it were a sacrament, it would help. I don't know. But at the moment, that's the only movement I think I'm interested in joining, or starting. There's others I'm willing to join. I don't know how many of you are acquainted with the Gospel in the Solent Anami. This is a record of the conversations about biblical stories in Nicaragua. There's four volumes of this. And this story, as it appears in Matthew, is reflected on in this volume of it. These are the poor people who are struggling to survive. Walter Altman, I assume, will be talking about base communities that get together and just sit down and talk about the scriptures. They read part of it and just talk, and with very little coming from the priest that is with them and leading them to talk. The conviction being that their own perception of what this story means for them, the message of, focused mostly on the message of Christ and many of his stories, just flows out and has been taped and written down. I hinted at it before. What do you think that the people of Solent Anami say about this story?
They would feel probably that last person whose 100 talents was not forgiven.
Okay.
Would be where I think that might start from. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Guess? Sure. Rich, you want?
Well, a light just went on for me. I'm testifying to this Bible fact. I think the people of Salaminami would have talked about those deaths. Also before, when you said, Elmer, that the small-time operator was still in the clink, mm-hmm. He didn't have to be thrown in the clink. He was in the clink. Mm-hmm. He did not know that this is life and death. And for these folks, didn't we used to pray, forgive us our debts? Now, you see, don't we make that too easy? When we'll forgive anybody their sins, but we won't forgive our 50-cent debt. This was really a matter of life and death for people, right? And we see the story as a matter of life and death. Strikes me, if we also see the flow of money as sort of hemorrhage or lifeblood.
Thank you.
Yeah. One thing that's sort of just going back to an experience, I just had a very brief visit in Central America this last year, but one of the interesting contrasts between El Salvador and Nicaragua was the forgiveness of rural debts, of agrarian debts. And I don't know if this would even come up in there, but one of the things that was just stark was that people in El Salvador lost their farms because of the drought that's going on, and that the banks are not committed to. Wherein, when we met the campesinos in Nicaragua, one of the joys that was in their faces, they said, no matter what happens, we are promised our debt will be forgiven. It will be, not forgiven, it will be refinanced until we can pay it. So that was, it's just an aside, but it was sort of, but it is, real interesting, because people who are Christian there talk a lot about the Christian principles that are involved in the Sandinista regime, and that kind of relates to this, that those farmers had great joy because they said, no matter how bad the drought is, we will have a chance to eventually repay, they will repay. So it's just an aside.
And here, those people weren't experiencing this death yet. And so they talk about the rich people being the king in the first place, and also the first person who had the debt. You don't run up $10,000 or $1 million debt unless you're rich. And so it was the refusal of both of them. First of all, the willingness to sell everything, which they said, what a tragic thing that is in that king. He was going to sell everybody off to get the money back. What a terrible thing that was in the first place. And the second one is that the other fellow, who even for $100 or whatever it is, was willing to throw the guy in too. So that the having of lots of money and withholding that from other people was the issue for them. And that if people were doing that, then they didn't understand what this story was about and would not have the forgiveness of God in them for what they were doing. And also, one fellow says in here, this is just about forgiveness. That doesn't have anything to do with the revolution. And I know how the rest of them respond, that to be a revolutionary, which is just another word for being Christian, except we don't believe that yet, is to know forgiveness for yourself and be able to forgive the others, and yet, like this story, expect something to happen. To have either one of those just forgive and nothing be changed in the society would not be to understand the story. And now one of the people said, I don't think the story is about money, I don't think the story is about anything else, except it is about love, and love is expressed through money. And if they would keep the money and not let us be equal, then they don't understand the story. And we have to understand that story among ourselves, be willing to forgive one another in our group, and be willing even to forgive the people who have oppressed us but yet to expect them to change. That makes it a tougher story, it seems to me. What do you think?
I was thinking about the experience of sharecroppers. It seems to me that people who, no matter how hard they work, at the end of the year, everything that the landlord pays them, they already owe him. You know, they have this sense of never being out of debt. We probably can't conceive of the full impact of a story because we don't have debtors' prisons now either.
They're not called that, but there are a lot of poor people in prison.
Yeah, but I meant not like England used to have debtors' prisons.
Yeah. Elmer, could you restate again what you said about the love part, what you just said?
Well, that was a quote from one of the people in here. Yeah. It said they thought that the story was really about love, that you had been stored up love because you had been given. That was one of your gifts. And he'd even say that a person who has been forgiven much, like an oppressor, if God's grace is available to that person, there is much love given to that person. And sin comes then in not sharing that love with others and not just saying, well, I love all those people. But I love all those people, and therefore I will give what I have to those people. So the forgiving was giving of funds so that there wouldn't be the distance between the rich and the poor. And that it wasn't, they thought, fair to talk about this story without dealing with the systems that they were living in. The one system which kept the money all here and made them get more money. And which the other kept the other people down here and kept them from getting any money. And if the talents or the whatever it is love, and then the story is you've got to share, because that's what love does.
And these Nicaraguan peasants figured that out. That's pretty good.
Yeah. There are theologians who go down there to learn. For sure. That's why I hope you catch some of Walter Altman's sessions, because I think he will be sharing what people in base communities and what the people who associate and listen to base communities studying the scriptures have to say to us. And it is radical. What have you asked her to sermon against pension plans? I don't know. Was the Missouri Synod wrong years ago when it was against insurance? How many people trust in their pension plans more than God? Got any idea? That may be a little radical, right? But I wonder. I wonder. I'm 65. I'm counting on it.
Why are they mutually exclusive?
Excuse me?
They're not really mutually exclusive. I mean, you can have pension plan and God both.
That's what most of us would say.
From God.
And I'd underline the word could be.
Well, my dad always said if all the people in Germany who put money in insurance had put it in the work of God, Hitler might never have happened.
Yeah, my questions would only be for each one of us to ask, is it?
Yeah.
Is it both or isn't it? And then the question comes to me from Titer would be, okay, what if I didn't have it? And most people don't, of course.
Your trust in God would have to be a lot more pure, more real, I think. I can see a pension plan as being simply prudent.
like you're supposed to be good. A pension plan is to me is prudent. You're supposed to be a good steward of what you have, so that you are able to be of help, able to be of assistance. If you can be a big, good business person with what you are able to earn, what God has given you, then you will be able to turn around and help somebody else. You see what I'm saying? But if you didn't have it, then you have to exercise your trust in God a whole lot more. So it's kind of a 50-50.
Richard, looks like you wanted to say something. No? Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
It seems like if the Christian community were operating as it should, we wouldn't need it. The problem is that it's not. In the early church, people didn't have pension plans. We don't trust each other enough.
You're 30 years closer to facing it than I am, so I'm going to ask, I'm going to throw it back at you. Why are you counting on it, and what would it be like if you didn't have it?
It probably would be good if I didn't. I'd just be saying I'm not at that point. I don't want to be dependent on my kids and dependent on, you know, on the government or whatever else. And I don't think that's admirable or Christian.
Are we in the clink?
Probably. I think we're in the clink. The same with, you know, it's the same story. I think it was the same story on dependence on nuclear weapons. We're going to have God and nuclear weapons. And the danger is, and I think it's a very real danger, is that we're trusting the nuclear weapons lots more than we're trusting God. I can't prove to you that anybody else is, but that's the scary part of me, of whether I am in the clink and can't trust. Yeah, because I think stewardship is mostly for giving away. Stewardship of the land isn't simply keeping it forever and ever. It's that the land does what God intended it to do, and that is to take care of the people. At least I believe that's what it does. Maybe you would think differently about that. I think the land has its own rights, too. I said yesterday, you know, God didn't make that covenant after the flood only with people, with animals, and with the earth. God made a covenant with the earth. And so it has its own rights and stuff too, but I think God's gift to us was that we are to steward the land in a way so that people are all taken care of. And as long as there's starvation around, as long as there are people who are oppressed because they don't have funds, they couldn't fight it in court if they wanted to, as long as there are people who live in a city that I came from where you haven't got a whatever chance to have your kids get a good education. When you know, as a black mother in Chicago, your son will not get a good job. How'd you like to grow up that way? Knowing your son will not get a good job. Can't. Or as the mother at Windsor Park Lutheran Church told me, if I raise my daughter to age 7 without being raped, I'm a good mother. That's a whole different story. And that's not caused simply by someone else. I think that's caused by us as well, in our clink of not being willing to share. And it doesn't promise that the whole world will be changed, you know. Friend of Politics of Jesus,
Yoder,
who will be here in a week or so, will tell us very clearly that we weren't called to be successful, we were called to be faithful. So it may not change everything, but what are we to be here for if we aren't here to be different? Yeah.
What was the second part? It says we weren't called to be successful, we were called to be what? I didn't hear the...
We were called to be faithful.
Faithful.
This thing about pensions.
Yeah.
I guess I don't like to hear the thing that it's sinful or bad to have pensions. I think if people can go into retirement knowing that they've got a pension, that they have the opportunity then to serve others rather than have to worry about how they're going to live or depend on their children and have to support them. I think pensions and the thought of saving or putting things away for that purpose, but then to be able to take that time and to give back to people to serve with all the time and the talent and the experiences that people who have gone through 40 years of work or 60 years, 65 years of life can share with us. I think that one should be the thing that should be lifted up, not the fact that pensions are bad. That's just my thought on it.
Mm-hmm. I guess what I was trying to... Excuse me. Yeah.
It seems to me that the middle class in this country has tried very hard to be stewards in the sense that Elmer was talking about, but we have become stewards in the sense of security at almost any cost. So whether it's national security, insurance security, pension security, or health, what happens, it seems, though, is that we forget that we're still ultimately dependent, and that's a good move. But in the process, we lose that sense that we're really always dependent. No security can change our dependence on God. But it's very easy to trust your pension plan more than God.
Well, I certainly wasn't saying that that should be the case, and that God comes first. But I think that the pension, having pension or working towards pension, gives you that opportunity to serve others in retirement.
I was thinking about what Barbara said last night about control and how all of this ties together, that the less we feel in control, the more we have a need to control everything around us. And the surrender is the freedom. The person in the story who forgave enabled the other person to forgive by that action, an action that enabled and freed. And what you said is my own struggle. The expectation and the challenge for change is so threatening until it's in light of the acceptance of what the person is. Controlling our environment and everything in it is an act of a desperate person, not a free person.
See, our premise, and I don't think I've tried to say that I could prove having a pension plan is a sin. My question was clearly, when does that get in the way of our relationship to God, whether we know about it or not? Don't forget, I still think the original sin is self-deception. And I think we're most good at self-deception. So we could talk ourselves into it quite easily, I would think, because of the humans that we are. But the assumption is, and I would say that it's for us probably a middle-class assumption here, I'm labeling it, may not be so, is that if we have enough money, we will be better able to serve others. And the question is that true? Are the people of Nicaragua who are poor more able to serve one another than the rich people of Nicaragua are able to serve? Not because they because rich people don't have a lot to do. They do, they have a lot of power. But whether they do or not, and whether in reality it is the poor that usually do the most serving, and that even that is at least biblically alluded to. And again, I'm not saying, I don't think God says in the scriptures that being rich is a sin, but what you do with it terribly is, and what it does to us. And if I feel that the Christian faith was mostly counterculture, it was at odds with what was going on. And where are we at odds with what is going on? is the question. You know, are we just people who think what's going on is from God and therefore that's fine? Or are we raising questions in ourselves and in others that maybe what is going on isn't so great if there are still people who cannot be free and whatever else you were saying, free from control and able to be free for themselves? That's the question I'm asking. I'm not on a binge to get people to accuse people of sin when you have a pension, but to raise the question about pensions. I think that's pretty worthwhile. Just because we are subject to messing it up.
We don't give until it's all gone. We may give to charities, we may, you know, but we never give all to just because somebody needs it. And I think a lot of those poor people in Central America are willing to share their last whatever they have. I was just thinking, I have a brother who married a Mexican lady. It's a delightful person. But she was forever keeping relatives and friends that migrated to the Northwest. And I kept saying, oh my goodness, how can they afford to keep all these people that come in and out of their lives all the time? But that was the style of the people down there, and you never turned anybody away. And they all survived, and they're doing fine. We wouldn't do that, you know, we wouldn't just take in everybody that came by, I don't think.
Now, there are stories, however, during the Depression era that people did take in other people from all different cultural backgrounds and ethics. And if you talk to the people in the northern part of the Midwest that were in mining and lumbering, the Italians and the Serbians and the Finnish people that still are living in rather depressed areas in the northern part of the Midwest, they did share their bread, and that's all they had. Or the venison.
Yeah.
That's all they had. They lived good lives.
So when you lose it, you discover that it isn't survival dependent. You don't have to depend on that for your survival. You might even thrive without it. You can't learn that until it's not there. To depend on, maybe that's what you trust in.
What have pensions done to honor thy father and mother? We have kind of a separation of independence of the generations, don't we now? I'm not saying that pensions are right or wrong, but isn't that part of our American culture now that?
If they have a pension, you don't have to take
care. Grandparents are supposed to be on their own. They're self-reliant. They should not count on their children to support them.
And the deduction is also, or assumption is also, that that's a happier way to live.
Being a grandparent and on a pension, I think it is.
We're going to discuss this privately.
The older I get, the closer I want to be.